realms of Atlantis. I'm Richard Walensky on Book Waves. Book Waves is produced by Richard Walensky in the studios of KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California. Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. Stephen Sondheim died at the age of 91 on November 26, 2021, a titan of American musical theater whose work both transcended and changed the genre itself. Sondheim was responsible for the lyrics for Gypsy and West Side Story and his own shows, Company, Follies, A Little Night Music, Sweeney Todd, Sunday in the Park with George, Into the Woods, and others. They all became classics in the field. His lyrics were both clever and deep. I interviewed Stephen Sondheim twice. This was the first of the two interviews recorded in San Francisco in November 2010 for the first volume of his autobiography and collected lyrics, Finishing the Hat, and it deals mostly with his career prior to the 1980s. Stephen Sondheim, since the title of the book is Finishing the Hat, a song from 1985, Sunday in the Park with George, it sounds as if you intended this to be one volume, but it just kept growing and growing.
I said to the publisher it could only be sold to Olympic shot putters, so I decided to do it in two volumes.
When you were working on it, what revelations happened?
No real revelations. I looked back at some old stuff and some of the cutout stuff, and actually, for the most part, liked it better than I'd remembered, or in many cases, a number of cases, just plain forgotten. But I was pretty pleased. So if you call that a revelation, I suppose it's one. But no, not a lot. Not a lot.
Well, you were pretty harsh on yourself through a lot of that early work. I mean, at this point, I guess it's as if you're reading someone else's work.
In a sense, it is. Yes, I'm fairly harsh on myself for sort of the Journeyman one, which was Saturday Night, which is my first. And then for West Side Story, which is something I wrote partly under duress, I'm critical, but I'm not quite as harsh.
When you're working on a song, how do you know instinctively exactly how long it should be? Or is that something that comes out as late as rehearsal?
Oh, no, not as late as rehearsal. No, it comes out as you're writing it. It's how much do you want to say? How much do you want to get accomplished on the song? And that sort of dictates when you stop. Like the opening of Sunday in the Park with George, the title number, there's a huge amount of exposition to be laid in for the audience there. So the number can't be a short one. Whereas a song like Passion, Loving You, she has one thing to say, and so it should not be a long song.
The songs that you write, you said they have to be clear, concise, and you pay close attention to how easy it is to sing, which I guess means ensuring that the diction could be understood.
Diction and breath. Absolutely, diction and breath. Since I write always with actors or performers in mind, I think of what the difficulties or challenges or problems will be for a singer, not just in terms of diction and breath, but also in terms of emotional attack. You know, is the song true to what the character is feeling? Is there something for the actor to play? All that has to be taken into consideration, I think. But the main principle of everything is clarity, and that's clarity of intention and clarity of diction, and et cetera, et cetera.
And it also has to be understood first time through.
Right, exactly. A song can only be heard as it's being sung. You can't go back over it.
You grew up under the tutelage of Oscar Hammerstein II. When your parents were divorced, he kind of became a surrogate father to you. Had you been listening to a lot of music?
No, it's just he was a songwriter, and I liked the theater. Oh, I hadn't seen much by the time I was 11, which is when I met him. It was by osmosis. I didn't immediately say I wanted to become a songwriter, but I went to a school where we put on a musical, and I wrote a musical there with two classmates. So I just got to like it, and I wanted to be what he was.
And apparently he taught you how to structure a song, finding the character, the voice, how to tell a story, and practical stage directions as well.
Mm-hmm.
In your work, how conscious was that, and how did that become unconscious? Did it ever become unconscious?
No, it's always conscious. You always got to think about such things as you're writing a show. Now, I don't have to think about it as much as the librettist does, or indeed as much as the director does, but you know, you have to allow time for somebody to change their costume. And that's a basic thing, and it sounds like an obviousness, but I can't tell you the number of scripts I've read where I've said to somebody, "But wait a minute, how does she get into the street clothes?" Oh, well, there's no answer. People don't think of that. They don't think of the practical side of the theater. The theater is a practical art. But Oscar was the one who sort of put that in my brain, said, you know, what do you intend with this stage direction, and how do you get this chair onto the stage?
Did he give you examples from his own work?
No, just from mine. I gave him this script that I wrote when I was 15, and in the, not even hope, but the assumption that he would want to immediately produce it on the stage. And he treated it as if it was a serious intent and treated me like an adult, which is, of course, exactly the way to teach. So he went right from the first stage direction on and said, why does this character not reappear? What does she mean by this? She said this on page 3. Why is she saying this on page 10? It's just lessons in basics.
He told you that you should take a play you like, musicalize it.
The idea was to take a play that I liked and thought was good and musicalize it, then take a play that I thought that I liked but that I thought could be improved and see if I could improve it as I was musicalizing it. Then take a story that I did not make up but somebody else had made up but that was not in dramatic form. In other words, like a short story or some non-play, non-theatrical form or a folk tale or whatever. And turn that into a musical in which I would have to do all the dramatizing myself, but I didn't have to make up the characters and the plot. And then finally, make up the characters, make up the plot, and write the musical. And that's what I did.
And two of those were Beggar on Horseback and High Tour. Looking back on them now, you don't include them, any of the material?
No, I debated including the stuff I wrote in school. Those were written in college. And I decided not to. I may, in the second volume, I might include a couple of very early songs in a chapter called Early Songs. But if I do, I'm certainly not going to include the entire score of the first show, which was called By George, which is the one I wrote when I was 15 because I went to a school called George School. And it was all about, you know, campus shenanigans and thinly disguised versions of the faculty. I did the same thing in college. My first college show was that way. But the play that I thought was a good one was Beggar on Horseback, and the play that I thought could use improvement was High Tour. And then I did, for the non-dramatized thing, I did Mary Poppins, and I didn't finish that because I couldn't figure out how to take a bunch of disparate short stories, even though they involve the same characters, and make them into one structure.
Which you kind of did with Company.
Not really, because, yeah, I suppose you could do Mary Poppins that way, but no, not really. I don't know. That's interesting. I'd have to think about that, whether you could do that with Mary Poppins. God knows, you know, I found the Disney movie ridiculously incoherent, and you know, it wasn't Mary Poppins. It didn't really have the flavor. And also, I don't think they solved the problem of how to make the stories into one coherent story. All they did was pad it with a love story, which doesn't belong there. So, I don't know. Maybe you could do it in the Company version. The trouble with that is Company had a real springboard, which is it had one central character viewing a group of other characters. I don't know who the central character in the Mary Poppins stories would be. You wouldn't want to tell it from Mary Poppins' point of view because that would take all the magic out of it. And so the real characters that you see through the eyes are the two kids. Now, the Karen McIntosh musical tries to make Mr. Banks, the father, a central character and try to give it some coherence by having him undergo a change of character as a result of the events. But P.L. Travers didn't mean Mr. Banks to be the central character, and he isn't. And that, to me, is false and forced. The two kids have to be the central characters, and I don't know that you could do a Company-type structure. I think you would have to find like an Alice in Wonderland structure.
Right.
Alice in Wonderland is from one point of view, and she has a series of disparate adventures. But Alice in Wonderland has never been successfully done as a show or as a play, because, again, it doesn't cohere. It just is. It's the worst of picaresque. It goes from incident to incident to incident, and like Candide, which is the same problem. Each incident has to be better than the one before or more entertaining, or else there's an anticlimax because there's nothing pulling you through. There's no goal to reach. They're just a series of incidents. And it just doesn't make dramatic sense. It's fun to read as a book, but it's not fun to see on the stage, at least I don't think so, or in the movies, unless you can find a way of making it a story.
Well, on something like Roadshow, Bounce/Roadshow, you are telling the disparate stories of individuals, but I guess it's leading toward...
It's leading, but it's about their relationship, and what it does is it resolves itself in their relationship. They have different adventures, but it's always about the two of them and their evolving and changing relationship. I mean, that's the intention anyway.
Stephen Sondheim, you make a great point in the book, and it's something that happens in novel writing, theatrical truth versus logical truth. You have to kind of bend the rules a little to make it work theatrically.
Well, you do a lot of compression theatrically, obviously, and in movies too. You don't take the time that you can take in a novel. You can't fill in the kinds of details that you can in a novel. You have to take sort of highlights from the characters' lives because they have to be scenes, and you can't sit around and just describe something or describe an atmosphere. The atmosphere has to play into the story. In narrative forms, anyway, you have to keep things going. There are review forms, which company is a hybrid of, but in the narrative form, each incident has to lead to the next incident. Each character has to interact with one character, which caroms, causes a change in other relationships. And that's what keeps surprising an audience and holding an audience's interest. Theatrical truth is also sometimes a matter of timing. Would she really have done that before she did that? Well, in the theater, yes. In real life, no.
When you're looking back on those early works, which do you think is the most successful from the standpoint of 2010?
The only show that's close to perfection is Assassins. That's the only one I can think of where there's almost nothing I would want to change. All the other shows have things I wish I could have figured out how to fix, or I see now are things that should be fixed. Only Assassins sort of comes out unscathed.
You were an assistant on Allegro, Rodgers and Hammerstein's flop. Cameron McIntosh said to you at one point that it seems like all you're ever trying to do is fix Allegro, and I sometimes get the idea that maybe now you're thinking in the same way about Merrily We Roll Along.
Well, first of all, we fixed Merrily. I'm not thinking about that at all. We fixed that in 1993, at least to my satisfaction, and to George's, George Firth, who wrote it. No, that was a matter of tinkering with the show till we got it the way we wanted it, because it had such a brief and troubled New York presentation, we never got around to doing the work we wanted to do. We did some, but there wasn't enough time to do all the work. And then also in 1985, James LaPine did a production of it, and that changed the whole thing, because he really was not only directing it, but was like a dramaturg. He pointed out things about the first half hour that George and I immediately went to work on, and that's what made the show turn the corner and into a good piece.
You were a writer for Topper, the TV show?
Yeah, that was my first job, my first paying job.
How'd you get that?
Oscar Hammerstein was a friend of a guy named George Oppenheimer, and I went to a dinner party, and George Oppenheimer was at this dinner party, and Oscar had invited me to this dinner party, and I was 21 years old. I'd been living for 2 years on a scholarship that I'd gotten when I graduated college, and the money had run out, and I needed a job, and Oscar wasn't really being my agent, but it happened at this dinner party that subject came up, and George was about to start writing this series called Topper, and he needed an assistant writer. So Oscar said, what about, and I had written a couple of scripts for television, neither of which had sold, but they were there to be read, and George read them and was impressed enough to say, you want to be my assistant? I didn't want to write for television, but I needed money, and I wanted to earn enough money to get an apartment in New York. So I worked out in L.A. for 5 months, and we did, meaning George and I, we did 11 shows together. That is to say, actually, we alternated shows. He wrote one, and then we would write one together, and then he would write one alone, then we wrote one together. I learned a great deal, because to tell a story in four acts in a half hour, knowing that there are commercial breaks, gives you a sense of economy and a sense of storytelling and a sense of how you lay an exposition, how you create little kind of mini curtain scenes. It was very valuable. And then I quit after 5 months when I had enough money to come back to New York and rent an apartment.
Did you also learn about how to deal on some level with how an actor would read your lines as well?
No, not as much, because I was not on the set very much. We did most of the writing in an office. I don't think George was on the set very much either. Remember, those are the days where shows were done very quickly. Each of these was filmed in 2 days, maybe three. I'm then edited in the next day or two. I was tailoring it, however, for given star personalities, or shouldn't say star, leading lady. The leading players were a married couple named Robert Sterling and Ann Jeffries, and they had very distinctive personalities. So I was writing for them. Among other things, for example, Ann Jeffries had a lot of difficulty pronouncing S's, so I had to keep plurals out of the dialogue as much as possible. And then Leo G. Carroll, who played Topper, who was a very distinctive personality, and Lee Patrick, who played Mrs. Topper, also a distinctive personality. So writing for them, yes. I was writing for personalities, but not really learning an awful lot about acting from an actor's point of view.
So did that only come when you were working on Saturday Night, or did Saturday Night ever reach a point of casting?
No, we'd started casting, and then it sort of fell apart. What happened was, went through two phases. The first one, we never got to casting. We did backers auditions, then the producer died. We raised about half the money, and the producer died, and so it went a mourning. And then after Gypsy, Julie Stein, who wrote the music for Gypsy, was also a producer, and he wanted to produce Saturday Night, and Bob Fosse wanted to direct and star it. And so we started casting, and then I got cold feet, and I said, I can't go back to old work, because now I'd done both West Side Story and Gypsy in between, and I really wanted to get on with it. So that stopped right there. No, I learned about acting, really, and actors from Arthur Lawrence taking me to the Actor's Studio when we were writing West Side Story. He wanted me to see acting from an actor's point of view, and that's exactly what the Actor's Studio was about. And I learned a great deal from that.
You're listening to an interview with composer-lyricist Stephen Sondheim, who died on November 26, 2021, at the age of 91. This interview was recorded in November 2010. I'm Rich Walensky on Book Waves.
You talk a little bit, particularly in terms of Glynis Johns tailoring a song to her voice. I mean, how often did that happen? Has that happened over the course of your
career? Not a lot, but I knew Elaine Stritch was going to play Joanne and Company, so before I wrote Ladies of Lunch, I knew that. Actually, I wrote two songs to entice Angela Lansbury to play Mrs. Lovett in Sweeney Todd, and once she said yes, then I knew I was going to be writing for her. I'm sure I could think of a couple of others, but those are the two that immediately come to mind. That's different than what I learned at the Actors Studio. That's writing for actors or singers' limitations, or actors if they have very distinctive personalities. Writing for an actor who does not have a distinctive personality but is merely playing the role is the valuable thing you learn from getting to know how actors approach their craft. And that's what I learned from Actors Studio. You know, if somebody can't sing above a C, then you don't write above a C. If somebody has a lot of sibilants, then you don't write a lot of S's. If somebody has short breath, like Glynis, you don't write sustained lines. Those are exigencies. That's not the same thing. Writing for an actor's, for what an actor can do, is much subtler. And that's what I was talking about.
A number of your works have become films. Arthur Lawrence, when I interviewed him about a decade ago, said that, in his view, the only films that can work are fantasies. Do you agree with that?
I don't know. I might have to think about that. I don't think musicals work on film, period. Film is just not a poetic medium. It's a repertorial medium. When characters break into song out of dialogue in film, it's an anomaly, I think, generally. This is a generalization. But I don't think I've ever seen what I would call a successful musical film that really tried to tell a story through song. The successful musical films, to me, are like the Astaire Rogers movies, in which you have essentially a set of comic scenes interrupted by songs that only tangentially have anything to do with the storytelling and are certainly not necessary to it. They are respites, interruptions, they're punctuation. The fantasies, I don't know.
He's thinking in terms of anything from, say, Top Hat, which takes place in the fantasy Venice.
But it doesn't attempt to tell a story. All of those movies, I don't think they're fantasies. They're entertainments. They're what Lenny would call divertissement. They don't attempt to tell a story through song, so they don't fall into this category.
The problem that I've seen in a lot of translations of, say, Broadway shows is that the moment that someone breaks into song, reality becomes fantasy.
Yeah, you can say that. And on the stage, that is perfectly consistent with what the theater is about. The theater is in no way real from the minute you enter it, whether it's a so-called reality play or not. I mean, you know, you try to make it as real as possible, but the fact is that there's a fourth wall missing and the actors are cheating out front, and that's just not real in any way, shape, or form. So the audience understands that when they come into a theater, and it's as if they've signed a contract saying, I understand that this is not going to be real, and therefore I will accept, and therefore I will use my imagination and imagine that these are real emotions and real stories. And as such, that works.
But when it comes time to West Side Story, I mean, Lawrence said that no matter how much he liked Jerome Robbins' choreography, you're never going to see gang members dancing down the streets of New York.
Right, and you're never going to hear dialogue like that spoken by anybody in real life.
You've said that for all the movies made from your work, that you're happiest with Sweeney Todd.
Yes, I am. I think he really made a film out of it. And he found a way. One of the ways was cutting out all the chorus stuff so that all the stuff is essentially internal. That is to say, that though the characters are often singing to each other, it's essentially close up. And he set up the style right in the first line. And if you accept that style, then I think it's a very successful movie. There are people who wouldn't accept it anyway. Also, Sweeney Todd is what I guess Arthur would call a fantasy. It's not real, wasn't meant to be real on the stage. It's a melodrama of the most over-the-top sort. And as in opera, it's way, way beyond anything real. You would never tell a story like that and expect it to be taken seriously as a play, only as a melodrama. Also, I think that's the only kind of thing that makes good opera, you know. I think operas have to be written in other kingdoms and other times with kings and queens, and I think as soon as people attempt to make them real, for me, they don't work. But it's certainly true in the movies, which is such a realistic medium. And I think that Sweeney Todd works very well because it's such a flamboyant story.
How do you feel about the videotaping, the recording of shows like Sunday in the Park with George or the original Sweeney Todd?
Oh, they're fine if you understand that they are records. They're archival records of plays and musicals is what they are. They don't attempt to be filming. And you make the same contract with one of those that you make when you go into a theater. You know what you're watching is a theater performance. You see theater scenery. And right away, you know you're not in a real street. You're in a cardboard street. And so it doesn't pretend to be anything except the filming of a play, the recording of a play. And so I don't think they're comparable at all to movies.
Starting with Merrily We Roll Along and Sunday in the Park, and I think Roadshow as well, there seems to be kind of a fascination with the relationship of art and commerce.
It dates right back to Beggar on Horseback. Beggar on Horseback is exactly about that. I wrote that when I was a sophomore in college. So obviously it's something I liked to write about. Not a pull, because then I spent many, many, many decades not writing about it. So it's hardly an obsessive thing. And, you know, I would argue that those three shows are... Certainly Merrily is about the pull between art and commerce, and Merrily is very much like Beggar on Horseback from that point of view. Roadshow is really more about entrepreneurship in the United States. It's not so much about art. It's not so much that Addison was an artist, but that he was a maker. He was a builder, and Wilson was a promoter. And those two aspects of this country, it's one of the things that defines America, I think. And what was the third one you mentioned? Sunday in the Park with George? Yeah, there's stuff about the pull between art and commerce and that, absolutely.
Stephen Sondheim, you talk a lot in the book, Finishing the Hat, about finding the right property which the songs will enhance it or take it in new directions. How do you determine that, or is it something that's kind of internal to whatever artist?
No, you got to track to a story, and then in examining it, you decide whether songs will merely decorate it or whether they can in some way, to use your word, enhance, and maybe even more than enhance, expand, or look at it from a different way. I mean, you could say, look, there's Romeo and Juliet and there's West Side Story. Or better yet, there's Lilium and there's Carousel. Or even more pointed, there's Oklahoma and there's Green Row of the Lilacs, the play from which it was taken, which is a play about homosexuality in the Western Plains. And that's not what Oklahoma's about. And you could say that Oscar took a rather grim play and made it into a lighthearted romp. Or you could say that he took an aspect of the play and expanded it, the pioneering spirit of the country that's in the play. So the point is, a story appeals to you, and it seems to me important to decide or to know that the songs are somehow going to be necessary to the new version as opposed to merely decorations on the old version. And that's something I think you only discover either as you write it or hopefully before that, you discover as you're talking about it with the librettist and planning it. You hope, because you don't want to spend a lot of time. I've often said that it takes just as much time to write a wrong song as it does to write a right one. It's easy enough to recognize a bad song, but not so easy to recognize a wrong song.
How far have you gotten into anything without suddenly throwing up your hands and saying, this won't work?
I'm not sure that's ever happened. It must have, but I can't think of any. Generally, my instincts have been, at least for myself, pretty good, but I can think of one or two examples where it didn't get beyond a couple of first talking sessions. You sort of know very soon. Also, it has to do with making a rapport with your collaborator, and the two of you have to be as enthusiastic and be sure that you're writing the same show and on the same train. There's a great danger with people that you like writing with that one or the other will drag the other one into a project. That's happened.
The Frogs.
No, I loved it. Really? Oh, no. I thought that The Frogs was just, we had no time to really work on it. You know, I did it as a favor, but the only thing that made it an unpleasant experience was Robert Brusty and lack of time.
So it would have been Do I Hear a Waltz?
Do I Hear a Waltz. That was a waste of my time, and I allowed myself to get talked into that. It's not a bad show. It's just an unnecessary one. There's actually a very good example. There's a show that does not improve or enhance or expand on or enrich the original play. It is the original play with songs. That's not enough.
Well, when you're looking at Broadway today, it seems like most of the shows that are based on films don't seem to have that purpose either.
That's correct. No argument there.
There's a political element to a number of your shows, imperialism in Japan for Pacific Overtures, capitalism selling out in Merrily and George.
And Roadshow.
West Side Story, of course, gang warfare. Mm-hmm. On a subtextual level, are you looking at the political life in the United States, or does that
No, the only... First of all, most shows imply politics, even if they're just social politics or even personal politics. The only overt political stuff that I've written are the shows with John Wyden. Assassins is overtly political, and Pacific Ocean is overtly political, and Roadshow is overtly political. Those are the ones. The others, yes, you can say that they're political. That was not uppermost, nor did I hasten that. John and I don't sit down to write a political show. It's just that John's tendency isn't the right word, but his attraction to political material is very intense. And I think when John starts to think up stories he wants to tell, they tend to be, with a capital P, political.
Someone in a Tree for a long time was my favorite song of yours, and then it was kind of fun to find out it was your favorite song. Yeah. You talk a bit about it, but what struck me the most is that you're telling a story, but you're doing it obliquely throughout the entire thing. Listening to the song about 10 times, and it may require that much, you realize that all of the information is there on what exactly happened in the Treaty House.
Oh, absolutely, no. But that's true of that whole... One of the things I love about Pacific Overtures is Chrysanthemum Tea, of course, is a fantasy.
Right.
Although it has a basis of truth, but it's not that. But indeed, that is what happened in the Treaty House, and the Admiral's Number is exactly what happened, chronologically, which countries came in, what they demanded from the Japanese, etc., etc. So as history lessons, both those numbers really are defendable.
Stephen Sondheim, Broadway today, what do you see?
I see the usual thing that's gotten worse over the years, which is the economic bind, which prevents producers from taking a chance on anything they don't think is safe. And what they think is safe is what they call the jukebox musical, where the audience knows the songs before they come into the theater, and therefore they're humming them on the way in, and they feel comfortable with what they're hearing. Or a song that comes with some kind of branding, like the Disney titles. You know, Beauty and the Beast, the title alone will sell tickets. And sometimes, in the case of Tarzan, they don't sell enough tickets. But that's what the producers think will sell. So nobody is taking a chance on unknowns. Nobody is doing anything original, unless, of course, it starts off Broadway and gets official imprimaturs from the critics, as in the case of, you know, Next to Normal and Spring Awakening and Rent and, you know. So those are the only chances that new work is ever going to come to Broadway now, is if they start in smaller theaters, get noticed, get praised, and then come in with some kind of guarantee for the producer.
You've been listening to an interview with composer-lyricist Stephen Sondheim, who died on November 26, 2021, at the age of 91. The interview was recorded in November 2010. A new regendered version of his musical Company is now playing on Broadway. I'm Rich Wolinsky on Bookwaves. An extended version of this interview can be found as a Radio Wolinsky podcast in the Area 941 section of the kpfa.org website. Bookwaves is produced by Richard Wolinsky in the studios of KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California.
Thank you. Portland, listener-supported community radio. Stay tuned for Shocks of Sheba, up next after these headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM.